What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore. We're back with our expert corner interviews. Every Friday, we get to talk to short-term rental investors and sharing the good, the bad, the ugly of this game of short-term rental investing. Our goal is always to help you walk into this game with your eyes wide open. And today, we've got Arthi Krishnamurthy joining us to talk about their journey into short-term rental investing. Arthi, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Excited about this conversation. I love these conversations. I always say before we hit record, this is just like you and I catching up and talking about the journey and letting other people listen in. And so it's always a pleasure that you are, I'm always thankful that you're willing to let people listen into that conversation. So before we start, though, those of the people who are listening, I always like to start with a backstory, with a background. What pays the bills? Where are you from? What got you interested in short-term rental investing in the first place? And then we'll dive into the journey of short-term rental investing.
Sure. So I've been a lawyer for about 10 years now, and I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and I've been moving around every few years, honestly, just to kind of move up in my career. So if there's been a better job or, you know, a better kind of position, I've been moving around. So I've moved from the Chicago area to Missouri, to Tennessee, to Texas, back to Missouri, and then back to Texas, and now I'm in the Chicagoland area again.
Again, right?
Yes.
You just keep bouncing around. Same companies or just same areas bouncing back?
A couple of them are the same companies. And now with remote work, I'm still with the same company based out of Texas. But I grew up in the Chicago area and we just had our first kid. And so it was nice to come home and be able to keep our jobs and just work remote.
Love it. Love it. Awesome. Motherhood, first year of motherhood. That's a whole change. There's a lot of time and effort involved there, right?
Yeah. I found out I was pregnant very close to when we closed on this first property. And I was like, oh no, this could not be worse timing, but right. it all worked out. But yeah.
That's awesome. Well, congrats. That's fun. It's always fun. The stages of, you know, being a parent, they're every one of them is different. And so it's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that for you guys.
Yeah.
So you practice law. What type of law?
Healthcare. So I've usually worked with hospital systems, but now I work for a gastroenterology practice management group. So usually the healthcare provider side.
Nice. Nice. I'm impressed that my enunciation of those big words is not very good. And so you threw that gastroenterology out really, really fluently. So that was good.
I have to say it a lot and explain what I do a lot. And people are still just like, I don't know what that means, but
awesome. Awesome. Well, what about that? So, you know, we got the career going, we got starting a family going. What in the past, have you guys had any real estate investing in the past? Like what were you doing anything before short-term rental investing?
About a year before finding you guys, we had gotten two long-term rental properties and we don't manage those. You know, we have a property manager for those. And I think it was our introduction to real estate and it was like sort of low risk in terms of, we don't really have to do very much. And we got very comfortable with that very quickly. And so about a year after that, we were like, well, what else can we do that's more active to offset that W-2 income to build the generational wealth we didn't have growing up? What else could we do to limit the amount of money that we have to depend on a W-2 employer, especially with having worked for so long, you kind of see different leaders and different companies and you're just like, you know, I'd really like to work for myself if I could.
Right.
There's a real benefit to that as you kind of work, the longer you work.
Right. I always love to know if somebody has invested in other real estate because, you know, there is, like you mentioned, and, you know, one of the big benefits is the tax benefits, but, you know, kind of being able to actively participate in that. And sometimes we underestimate the active participation in short-term rentals compared to long-term rentals, right? There's a lot more moving parts there and can have some, you know, can have some real benefits to that. But the trade-off is it's not as passive as probably what you have realized with the short-term or the long-term rentals that you started off with.
Yeah. The long-term rentals, they're great, but it's sort of a volume. Like if you wanted to rely on that for retirement, it's a volume game and you have to have a lot of money to be able to, you know, pay off a bunch of long-term rentals.
Right.
So
yeah, that's one of the things I love about short-term rentals. You can have a much, much smaller portfolio and have a better net on the back end with a much smaller portfolio. Yeah, long-term rentals, you're trying to, you know, it's a numbers game. You got to have enough of them to start paying some bills.
Yeah. I think I thought it was a great idea at first, and then we got a few and it was easy, but I was like, this is not going to move quickly.
Right. Yeah.
So
when I started in my long-term rental journey was back in the early 2000s, but I got up to about 52 single family homes, and most of them single family homes. I had a couple duplexes sprinkled in there, but most of them were single family homes and 52 units. And I that's a lot of houses. Yeah. And I was making about $4,000 a month in income. And I'm like, that was a lot to purchase, a lot to manage, a lot to deal with for $4,000 a month. You know, I wasn't even averaging $100 a door back then. And that was almost 30 years ago. That was 26 years ago when I built that portfolio. Now it would be awesome because I'd have, you know, the rents had gone up, they'd be paid off, all that stuff. But at the time, it's a long process with buying a lot of properties. And so, with short-term rentals, I don't have to, you know, one property can bring me in that $4,000 a month. I don't have to have 52 of them. Right.
Yeah.
So you got interested in short-term rentals. Was it initially a tax play? Was it, what was the initial attraction towards short-term rentals? Was it a lifestyle asset type of a play? Like was it a combination of many of the above, or like what really got you interested in short-term rentals?
I think it was a combination of things. I knew that we needed to do something differently that would show, you know, cash flow faster than the long-term rentals if we wanted to kind of get those goals that I kind of previously mentioned. And the long-term rentals weren't going to do it. And so I was like, what other active businesses are there that I would actually enjoy doing that kind of suit my personality, both of our skill sets. So my husband is in finance and accounting and I'm a lawyer. So like, I think combined, those seem to make sense. Like some of the other things we considered as I kind of went through the thought process of it, like I think you could do like flipping mobile homes. Like we just thought of all these different things that you could do. And I was like, you know, so many of these two things are like a gruel of hustling, which neither of us has the time to do. And you have to be constantly doing it. Like each time is like a boost of income, but you can't just like do something and then let it grow. So we were going back and forth. I think towards the end of discovering that we wanted to do short-term rentals, we had also seriously considered rental arbitrage. And we went back and forth with that quite a bit. And then I realized that it really didn't suit my personality in terms of like, when I do something, I want to do it really well. And I'm very type A about it. And we wanted to build something. And those are rentals. You don't own them. Yeah. You don't build anything. The tax benefit isn't there to either. And so I was like, you know, I think purchasing properties that we're proud of and that align with us genuinely and we can put in effort into and won't lose like the property made a lot more sense. And it sort of just like worked out to be like, that was the one that made the most sense, that worked with our personalities. And I think sounded the most fun. Everything else sounded just like another job. And I was like, I don't need another job. I already have a job.
Right.
Yeah.
That's awesome. It's interesting for me hearing that you guys were really considering arbitrage, because that doesn't seem like something that would be the right fit for you guys at all. No. But in the beginning, it seems like, you know, and those of you that are listening, what arbitrage is you go lease a property and you basically then set it up as a short-term rental and sublease it back out. So you make that spread on whatever your rent payment is to the current owner. You don't own those properties. And then you rent it out on the short-term rental side and you make the spread in the middle. And it is, that's much more of a side hustle, like a business, right? Yeah. It's almost like you're building like a little bit of an arbitrage management type style business, where you're getting that upside from the rent payment to the retail buyer on the short-term rental side. But like you mentioned, there's no tax advantages, there's no ownership options, you don't get any appreciation, you don't get no pay down, all those different things. You're only getting that arbitrage there. And so I'm glad that you realized that before you dove into it, because it's my least favorite part of the, you know, path to wealth, because I just think it's a side hustle.
When I was doing the pros and cons initially, I remember thinking, well, it's a lower buy-in because you're not buying a property. Sure. And so I was like, and it's like, people talk about it being such high cash flow because you can have multiple properties. But then I was like, this is again, like this constant, like you're going to be constantly churning and working and hustling. And I realized that was not going to suit. Like I couldn't do every one of those. If the goal is to have like 30 arbitrage properties, not all of them are going to be at like the A+ level. You can't do that like with a full-time job. So it just didn't make sense.
They are, like you said, your initial buy-in seems less. But if you really think about it, like back in the right after COVID and stuff, that when short-term rentals were the shining star of everything, basically, if you had a short-term rental, you looked like a genius investor, right? And so during that time, arbitrage worked really well because you could get these properties, lease them out. You didn't have to invest a lot into them, right? They had to be furnished, but having a nicely furnished property made you a decent amount of money. Nowadays, though, it doesn't, right? The game is played at the top of the market. You got to furnish these properties beautifully. You have to have these immersive experiences, all that stuff. It would be really, really hard sell for me to go spend 150 grand on the back end of somebody else's property, right? So like I have almost zero interest investing into those immersive experiences in somebody else's property. And now that is where we're seeing a massive advantage in the game. So the arbitrage folks are really, you know, naturally not going to compete with the owners in the game because the owner is willing to invest in the property.
Yeah.
The arbitrage person is not. And so, yeah, it's very interesting.
It's definitely going after a different, like, guest.
For sure.
Demographic.
Yeah.
For sure.
Much different. And so, well, I'm glad that as you're listing those pros and cons, Adam, I think.
Yeah. There's a lot of things we consider, and I'm very glad we didn't do a lot of those things.
Nice. That's awesome. The ownership model definitely suits you guys much better, I believe. I think everybody, if they can do it. But you're right. There is like one of the cons of short-term rental investing is the capital required on the front end. And, we're buying properties, we're setting it up, we're furnishing these properties, and not everybody's in a position to do that. So sometimes those arbitrage models are a better way for somebody to get in the game. But if you can afford the ownership model, there's a lot more benefits. And so as you made that decision to dive in and buy properties, did you already have a property area in mind? How'd you choose your location?
I don't think we had an initial property area in mind, but the more I did research, the more I was like, well, we're trying to keep our risk as low as possible, at least with this first one, because it's different for us. It's betting on ourselves, really, right? And we're pretty risk averse, the both of us. And so we were like, well, we have to make sure that it's going to do well. And so we settled on East Tennessee in Sevierville because something that I had learned was that even in like a downturn of the economy, people will still go on vacation, but they're more likely to drive. And it's such a good location for people to be driving from all directions. Like it gets so much traffic in a regular year. So I thought that made me feel better about, like, you know, you don't know what's going to happen with like COVID or anything else that could happen in the future. And so between that and my husband is from Memphis and he went to school in Knoxville, we were like, there's a little bit of connection there. Most of his family is still in Tennessee. We would be able to share that with family and friends. So I had never actually been there before we decided on that market. But it just sort of like hit a lot of the boxes in terms of comfort.
Right. Yeah. That's it's interesting. I always try to, as you're talking, just so you'll get used to this kind of conversation. I try to unpack a few things you say. And so one of the things I've unpacked there is when you're analyzing the market, one of the things we talk about is, you know, in good times and in bad times, drive to destinations do really well. And so, and they almost do better in times of like kind of economic downturns or recessionary times or whatever else, because people still want to vacation. And, you know, that market of the Smokies is, I think they say 3/4 of the US population is within a 3 or 4 hour drive of that market. Yeah. I mean, so that's a massive amount of people that will always be going there. So what you're selecting that market is hedging your bet to say, we feel really comfortable. We're always going to have demand for that market, which I would agree. And so I just wanted to kind of unpack that for the listeners as one of the kind of decision points of you guys steering toward that market. So massive demand, the number one national park in the US as far as visitors every single year the second closest is Yellowstone, and I think they double or triple what Yellowstone gets. And so it's a massive draw. And so, but there's a lot of competition, right? There's a lot of properties there. There's a lot of people with properties there. And so, you know, one of the things that scares people many times is saturated markets, is a lot of competition. We always talk with Invodacy saying, you know, replace the word saturation with demand, right? And so we just talked about demand on the front end, which is why you chose it. Were you worried at all about the competition? Were you worried about, you know, when it started to say, hey, there's a lot of properties that we have to compete with? Was that part of the discussion on the front end at all?
It was part of the discussion, and I was a little bit concerned about it at first. We had a realtor that I felt really good about, she was explaining how big the market is and like how many properties there are. And she really helped us narrow down, like, you want to get something that looks like a cabin because people come here for the cabin experience. Yeah. Like, there's plenty of properties here that are modern or new or not the cabin experience. So I was able to narrow that down. And then another thing that she was like, she really pushed on was like, you need to have something with a view because that's not going to be replaceable. And everything else, I mean, there's plenty of cabins and there's a huge price range of cabins, but there aren't a ton of cabins that have a great view. I mean, there are plenty that are in the Smokies and might have a view, but so we made sure that if we were going to be in a saturated market, that we were going to kind of be exactly what people were looking for, a cabin, like a wooden cabin, and that we would have a view. So when we looked at a lot of the properties that were in the price range, most of them did not have a good view. And we landed on one that did have a good view. It had like a beautiful view. And it wasn't actually our top pick when we had looked at properties before going there in person. And then when we got there in person, we were like, oh, wow, this is an amazing view, but it needed a lot of work. And so they had it priced fairly high, and we had to like get it restained and we did a lot of work to it. So I think it took a minute for it to be ready to go. And the other thing with that cabin that we found was, I don't think it looks as good in pictures as it does in person. And so one of the things we're dealing with right now is, so how do we get better pictures to really capture the views? Because that's why it didn't sell, I think, initially, is because I think when people look at it and when it was listed, they weren't seeing.
They didn't realize what they had. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one. We love that when we're buying properties, right? We love when they don't do a good job of articulating that on the front end, because when we see them, we're like, oh, this is kind of flying under the radar, right?
Yeah.
Makes it to where you can pick up some of those properties. You also mentioned leaning on those realtor partners to kind of help identify the buy box, right? And saying, and that's one of the things that we do in every one of these markets. Every market has certain kind of things that we're looking for. The Smokies, long-range views are massive, a massive advantage, right? They're not, every property doesn't have it, like you said, but the ones that do, you can't replace it.
Yeah.
And people love going there for the view, again, and understanding the experience that people want. They want the cabin in the woods experience, right? And saying, okay, this is where we're defining that buy box. And then we find the one with the view. And even though it might not be our favorite choice as far as, you know, the property, maybe the condition had some deferred maintenance, you had to do some work on it, you realize that that's a good trade-off. I can fix all that stuff. I can't fix the view, right? So proud of you guys for like sticking to that buy box, because a lot of times buyers will look and say, well, I'm going to go for the really brand new construction or the newer one that I don't have to do any work on. And they forget about one of the main things that they can't change, which is the proximity, the views, all those things. When you find the right one there, we deal with a lot of stuff on a property because we can fix that. We can change that. And so sounds like you guys did that. You obviously, hopefully budgeted for that on the front end, time-wise and money-wise. Did it, how much did it delay time to go and be, you know, where you had to do some fix up before you could launch it?
I think it delayed a couple of weeks, not too badly, but
not bad then.
No, I was pretty on top of trying to get these contractors to come in and do everything right away. Yeah. But it was like a lot of coordinating and managing and, you know, being on people as you kind of have to do with contractors. Because it delays everything, right? So if we were going to, so in hindsight, if we had used a lot of the Bodicey partners to do some of that work, like the design or the photography, it would have all been delayed based off of that. So we used a lot of local partners. And some of that I do regret doing, but timing wise, I was like, I want to get it listed because the mortgage is going to start, right? So there's some learning lessons there, but kind of is what it is at this point.
Yeah. So you mentioned that it was, you know, and even right now you're saying you don't feel like you feel like it looks better in person than what you're articulating those views. One of the things that is hard, I will say, views are very hard to articulate in photography because just like I live out here in the mountains out west and, you know, I'll take pictures from my house and I'm looking at this, you know, this 10,000 foot view or peak that's right in my backyard and it's snow capped. And I take a picture and I'm like, that doesn't even look that big. It doesn't even look that impressive. It's like, and it just, sometimes that stuff is harder to capture when you're taking pictures. And so it is a nice surprise, but we need to be able to articulate a good job of what we have to offer as well. And so it's kind of that, you know, we don't want it to look so good that people are disappointed when they get there, but we need it to look good enough to where when they walk in, they're like, yeah, this is what I thought I was getting. Not, you know, because if I don't do that, at least my marketing suffers a little bit because I don't have any other way to book somebody other than my pictures. And so Is that something you're currently working on? Is that something that you're just like, hey, listen, it's still operating okay. We're okay. We like the surprise at the end. And the guests are always, you know, really happy when they get there because it's almost better than they expected. Or is it something you're like, I'd like to up the game on the marketing side to articulate that a little bit better?
I think we are going to get photos redone as soon as possible. We're sort of working mm-hmm. through that right now, because the numbers aren't exactly where I want them to be. And I knew it was going to take some time to get reviews and have a little bit of momentum before we could, you know, be making the numbers. I wasn't expecting to have the numbers I wanted the first year, but we're kind of approaching on the first year and they're not quite as high. And really the people are booking very last minute as opposed to like in advance. And that might be something with the economy and just the timing, but at least in this market, when I look at the other properties nearby and our competitors, they're getting bookings further out than we are. And so, you know, I think that the photos will help. I think one thing that I did initially, and I don't regret it, but I wish I had done it differently, is I designed a lot of the things in the cabin myself, and I did it to my taste. And it's a little bit more neutral than I think is appealing to somebody that's going on vacation. And so adjusting that a little bit is a learning lesson for me, is that even though I like it and maybe people would like it, it's not the typical attractive, bold, colorful look that is going to stand out. And so I have to kind of set aside what I would want for personal that. Taste, yes.
You know, what's interesting about that is it's not that everybody doesn't like it. Most people, like every model home you see from builders and everything else, they're very neutral. They're very like, you know, very really congruent, neutral, monochromatic type design. And it's very pleasing to the masses. Like most of us like it, right? But what it does is it's hard to stand out. It doesn't really evoke, like bold colors evoke emotions and they evoke actions and they evoke different things from consumers. And so like you know, within the Vodacy family, it feels like that bold design is commonplace. It's really not commonplace out in the marketplace, right? And so, but that's why it stands out so well with what we do. But it's a little scary to do because it's not our personal preference when it comes to actual design, right? You're finding out, and I love that you brought that up. You're finding out what we talk about a lot is, when people are there and when you're there, they love the design, right? It's not that people don't like the design. It's just one of those things that it's like, it's so pleasing that a lot of people lean in that direction. And so there's not really anything that's making them stand out. Right. And so you need to have those elements of, you know, stopping the scroll and getting, you know, evoking enough emotion and having enough bold, like colors are very funny when it comes to marketing. They evoke certain emotions and actions. And so we need to have that like baked into our listing because we don't have the ability to sit and talk to somebody like, hey, you know, if I'm talking to you about the property, or you're talking to me about the property, you're like, hey, Sean, these views are amazing. You're going to love this, what we do here, the fireplace sitting over here, blah, blah, blah. Like, we don't get to do that. The only thing that we have is the photography and the design in the photography to get somebody to take some action. And so it's interesting because it's not what we normally would do as far as a personal preference. Right. And so it's sometimes hard to do that on the design side. So
yeah, I don't think like the average consumer. And so like when I look at places that I want to rent, I'm like, what would I want to buy? It's kind of how I feel when I look at something to rent. So I'm also not really looking at like the bold colors or anything. I'm like, what would I want to own? Because this is going to be like a chance for me to pretend that I own this place for whatever vacation. So I'm still not looking at bold things. So when I hear that that's what other people may do, or that's the psychology behind it, I guess it's just a learning lesson for me is that.
Yeah, it is. It's funny just understanding consumer behavior. But like what you just said, like you have to listen to the podcast that just aired on Wednesday. We were talking about how women make decisions on buying decisions, how men make decisions on buying decisions. But one of the things, like there's seven things that we kind of went over, but one of the things that how women make buying decisions is they like to buy what they would like to own, right? So it's actually very natural for a woman to do that. Like, but they also, now that you're a new mom, I'll tell you, as you start to book properties and the family grows, you start to also think about where would my kid have fun? What would be really exciting for them? And like all those things. And so there's different layers of making a decision. But like when we're like, just as a, like women, they book stuff that they would like to own. Like that's a natural thing. So it's funny that you mentioned that.
That is funny. I'm going to have to listen to that.
Yeah. You have to go listen to that. So we've got that. We've got the property. We're rolling into year one. And obviously year one is we're really trying to figure out what we need to double down on, what we need to change. Like year one is never our highest revenue or income year. We're always, like I always say, it takes about 12 to 18 months to stabilize properties fully to where we really can get them to where they're hitting on all strides. And so right now it sounds like that's where you guys have been with year one. We're identifying some things we like, we're identifying some things that we might double down and change or make some adjustments on. There's other things that we're going to stick with. And so are there any other things that you guys are eyeing on the property right now in that first year that like you're saying, hey, listen, we love that we did this. We want to change this. Is there anything we haven't talked about that year one is being identified?
The adding the color and retaking photos, but I don't think there's anything else really big at this point. I'm curious to see how much that makes a difference.
And sometimes too, you can add a lot of color without changing the full design, right? Like we add color with edibles, right? Like we'll have, if I need some oranges, you know, I'll put a bowl of oranges and that's a, you know, really contrasting bright color. And then maybe a couple flutes of, you know, mimosas or something, right? Or I'll just figure out what my color pops I want and I'll put them in there as edible items that are kind of setting those scenes. And so that can give you some really good color pop too, as you're kind of going through that and making some of those decisions where you're not really making a full design change. What you're doing is just trying to bring your design up to speed a little bit and up, bring it to life, right? My wife would like, she likes, we bought our cabin in Blue Ridge and she's like, I want the leather, the metal and then like everything is like whites and browns and like neutral tones. Right. And so it's like this cabin with a very, like, it looks like it came out of Restoration Hardware. That's what she wants it to be. Right. Like everything very monochromatic. That's what it is. And, when we were doing our design with Mike and we were putting our photography in and we did a fall room, right. And the fall room is, got the orange in it and everything. And she's like, nope, you're not putting orange in my cabin, right? She's like, we're not doing that. And we ended up still doing it, but we did tone it down because of her preference. But then when they did the photo shoot, Brian and Katie went in and they were using this orange color pop against all the neutral brown tones and the whites in there. And again, it's like almost of all the colors they could choose that she is the most offended of, it's orange. And so, and then they went this whole photo shoot and they did the orange throw pillows and the orange stuff, like flowers and stuff. And it turned out beautiful. And she actually really liked it at the end. But while they were doing it, we're in Utah, they're in Georgia. And I think if she could have reached out and smacked them, she would have. And so you might feel some of that as you're going through this.
I think, that makes me feel better because it's like, I know that I'm not going to want the color there, but I know that it's the right thing to do.
Right. It's have you seen our property in Cherry Log? You probably seen
it. Yeah, I have. It is well done and it's very nice. And I like the use of color there, but I'm still like, but I don't want the color in my place.
I know. She was like, and she was okay because it wasn't permanent color, right? Like there was nothing that was like kind of permanent there. It made it pop a little bit better. So
yeah.
The other thing too is, with your guys' views, the other thing that you ought to, and you might have already planned on, I can't remember, I don't think you did in your listing when I was looking at it recently, is it's those seasonal photos, the fall foliage and getting those drone photography that usually that first year, you're really trying to get those really good seasonal photos in an area like you guys are in. And that just you're just waiting. You're waiting for the leaves to change, right? And then get that perfect time where you can get in there and get those long range views of the fall colors on the mountains. Those are real good money shots when it comes to booking properties. In fact, we use our fall photos all year long on our Georgia property. I have summer photos, winter photos, fall photos, and even if I take and put the summer photos in the summertime, they don't convert nearly as well as the fall photos because of the colors, and the colors evoke emotions. And so as you're kind of navigating this year, if you haven't done that, if you didn't do that last fall, you really want to plan on that when you're in an area like you guys are, especially when you've got a property with the views that you have.
Yeah, I definitely want to do that this year. I wanted to do it last year, but then we had such a good fall booking season. Went so well. I was like, and I was in my third trimester. I was sort of like, it's fine. We'll just deal with it. And I even wanted to go to the property ourselves. And I was like, that's just not happening. I feel terrible. I wanted to do it last year, but we definitely need to do that this year.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, listen, this has been a good conversation. It's fun to talk about the things we would do different, the things that we're looking forward to. What's the plans for the future? Any other acquisitions on the horizon? What are your guys' plans as far as building the portfolio and what does that look like?
I think our initial goal was to have one a year. And then having the baby, I realized that time is so valuable. I've always struggled with like the time value of money and the value of our time. Like if I'm capable of doing something like mowing the lawn, I should do it. And I think we've finally gotten to the point where it's like, no, like that doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make sense to not hire somebody to do some of the work for us if we can do that and spend time the way we want to spend time. So with you rolling out the WGL program, I'm hoping we can do a property that way instead of trying to do it on our own this year. Yeah. Because it just wouldn't happen if I had to do what I did last year. And I mean, even if I could pull it off, there's so many other things in our lives going on right now. So
you want to spend the time with you.
Yeah. Yeah. You only have a baby for a little bit.
Exactly. They grow up fast.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Everybody tells me that. So hopefully we can make that work. And I definitely learned my lesson with that first property about the value of time because it's time consuming, and it's great if you have the time to do it. And like, it was enjoyable to some extent, but when you work full time and we were moving across country and pregnant, like it was just too much.
And you end up making just the fall photos. We're like, man, we're just kind of at the end of our rope. And we're like, it's okay. I'll deal with it next time. Right. And so some things do get pushed off because of that. Right. Because we're like, I'd rather have my time in my energy focused on something else, which is perfectly fine. Right. Yeah. But at the end of the day, sometimes things get pushed off when that's where we're at.
Yeah. And I think if we are using you guys to do like a second property, it wouldn't be as rushed if we were doing it on our own because, you know, we're coordinating all these people to like make things happen in a certain timeline. But if you guys are the ones doing it and you had all the connections, it's a little different. And so it seems like it'll work out a little bit easier that way too. Like I spend hours and hours doing something that might take somebody else with actual experience an hour.
Right. Exactly. It's not the first time we've done it and you're figuring it out the first time. Right. Yeah. I totally agree.
Yeah.
What I'll do is we'll team up on this one. And then if the contractors and the people aren't doing what they need to do, I'll just call you up and say, Arthi, I need some letterhead that I can write a letter on. I need some like intimidating letterhead that has some, a law firm on it. Right. So we'll team up on this next one.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, listen, as we wrap up our conversation, this has been fun for me. And I know our listeners, these are by far our favorite and most popular episodes. But I always ask the same question at the end of all of these, which is, if you could give your younger self some advice, what would it be? I know we talked about a lot of different things we would, were lessons learned along the way. Is there anything that comes to mind as far as your younger self going into this next one? What piece of advice would you want to share?
I think it sounds so scripted, but like start investing in real estate earlier, figure out what you like in a side gig earlier. Be willing to bet on yourself. I think about, like I've said, the value of time and the value of your money. And I think for a long time, I wanted to eliminate all of our debt, which was a lot of student loans because I put myself through school. My husband put himself through school. And if I thought about it now, it would have been that I wouldn't have paid it off so aggressively and maybe used some of that to invest differently. And I think we'd be in a different place right now. We had, wanted to take that risk or bet on ourselves that way. Yeah. But hindsight is 2020, right?
It is, right? We learn, and it's such a, I mean, it's by far the number one answer we get. And there's a reason, because it's true, right? You mentioned the time value of money. I mean, the sooner that money starts working, the more compounding can take effect. All of these types of investments, you know, it's okay to bet on yourself a little bit. We're not trying to bet it all on black. You know, we're not trying to gamble with this, which is why that time value is so important of starting sooner, because the more conservative you are, the more you just need that working for a little bit longer, right? And get that built up. And then before you know it, you look back in 3-5 years and you're like, oh, look what just happened. And it's real easy to kick the can down the road 3 or 5 years before you do anything. And I think that that's why we get this answer so often, is when you finally did take the leap, you're like, that wasn't quite as hard as I thought it was. It was hard, and I'm proud of myself, and I had to overcome a lot and spend some time, but I could do this again. You know,
I think I almost need the financial stability to be able to take the risk. And I wish I was a different person in that way, that I was more willing to take risks, or I had somebody that encouraged me to take that risk and, you know, say, how much can you invest? Like, set it aside, don't do X, Y, Z, pay off your debt right away.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Arthi, this has been a fun conversation for me. I appreciate you spending time and having this and letting other people listen in. Those of you that are listening in, we very much appreciate your time as well. And the only favors I ask you at the end of every episode is, the first one is, if you got any value out of this, our goal is to help people walk into this game with their eyes wide open. Share the show with somebody you might think would like to be a part of these conversations as well. If you don't have anybody to share it with, I don't run sponsorships or ads on the show, so the only way it grows is if you guys give us a like, a thumbs up, and the algorithm will go find other people just like you. And so if you do that, those things are very, very much appreciated. The final, most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode is, pick that one thing you can do today. Start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey, Grace, is there a website?
Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.